Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Health care reform makes history this week. Rage in response and a U.S.-Israel standoff in the news. On Tuesday, in the East Room of the White House, President Obama signed the landmark health care legislation into law.
Today, after all the votes have been tallied, health insurance reform becomes law in the United States of America.
But even before the bill's passage late Sunday night, as the vote came close, House Republican leader John Boehner blasted Congress and set his party's tone for the week.
Shame on this body. Shame on each and every one of you who substitutes your will and your desires above those of your fellow countrymen.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu felt a frost at the White House but made no apologies on policy when he spoke to AIPAC, the conservative Jewish American lobby.
The Jewish people were building Jerusalem 3,000 years ago, and the Jewish people are building Jerusalem today. Jerusalem is not a settlement, it's our capital.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. You can join the conversation. How do you see health care and the country at the end of this week? What's your take now on the U.S. and Israel? Google out of China, the Pope in hot water. You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us now from Washington is David Gergen. He served as advisor to Presidents Nixon, Ford, Reagan, and Clinton. He's now professor of public service at Harvard's John F. Kennedy School of Government. David Gergen, welcome back. Great to have you this week.
Thank you, Tom. It's good to be here.
With us from Dallas, Texas, is Bill McKenzie, editorial columnist for the Dallas Morning News. Bill, it's great to have you with us as well.
Thank you, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, where it was 20 degrees this late March morning, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at The Atlantic, is with us. Welcome, Jack.
Hello, Tom, David, and Bill.
David Gergen, where does our country stand at the end of this week?
Uncertain, divided, a bittersweet day this past Sunday when it passed the House of Representatives. Of course, it was an enormous triumph from the point of view of Democrats who have been working for this for generations. John Dingell, whose dad was in the House of Representatives back in the New Deal, introduced health care legislation under Harry Truman, and here the son has been serving for some 55 years trying to push this. Just imagine the elation in John Dingell. And yet at the same time, as you know, Tom, and everyone else knows, there was a bitterness on the other side, a sense that this was imposed on a country that was resisting. And unlike the other major social legislation of the past, this unfortunately went with just a partisan vote.
And so here we are, Bill McKenzie. You know, some days the rhetoric here can just sound irreconcilable, though I know it was a reconciliation bill in Washington. What works the country, what works the parties through this bill? We hope it's not more of the kind of violence or vigilantism we've seen, but what gets us to the other side of this canyon?
We're right, absolutely. We hope it isn't the vigilantism and the violence. I think it has to start with some Republicans from the right wing starting to speak out and say, you know, there's a good reason to oppose this bill, but we're going too far with our followers perhaps are going too far with some of their opposition to it. I was encouraged to read today that Rick Perry, our governor down here, who I would say would come increasingly from the Sarah Palin wing of the Republican Party, he spoke out about it. I don't have his exact words, but the fact he did, and he did it in a pretty direct way, I think was encouraging. And so I think it's going to have to be Republicans first starting to police their own. I think there was a legitimate reason to oppose this bill on the cost control and deficit reduction aspect of it. Unfortunately, Republicans didn't make that argument. They didn't make it very well, at least. And they, you know, went back to sound bites about socialism and government takeover. I don't think it's socialism or government takeover. I think it's more of a threat to something we've talked about here before about future generations and the level of debt they may pay. And there was a real reason to make that case. They didn't do a very good job of it. Now I think they need to rope in some of their outliers. And likewise, I think that I read Eric Cantor saying, well, you know, my office also, I think in Richmond, was the subject of
bullet
of,
through the window earlier this week, you said.
So it's on both sides, right? Both sides have to be able to speak out against this. And then they are, but I mean really speak out of minute and really drive the point home. And unfortunately, it's going to take us some time to work through this.
Jack, I want to hear you. Let's hear the president first. This was at the signing in the East Room of the White House, talking as he signed the health care reform about the character of the country.
We're a nation that does what is hard, what is necessary, what is right. Here in this country, we shape our own destiny. That is what we do. That is who we are. That is what makes us the United States of America. And we have now just enshrined, as soon as I sign this bill, the core principle that everybody should have some basic security when it comes to their health care. And it is an extraordinary achievement that has happened because of all of you and all the advocates all across the country. So thank you.
President Obama at the signing describing what he called an extraordinary achievement. On the other hand, Jack, here's Mike Pence writing in the Wall Street Journal, Indiana Republican congressman. He says, I say, not an extraordinary achievement, he says, I say we broke with history, turning our back on this country's finest traditions of limited government, personal responsibility, and the consent of the governed. Mm-hmm. Saying this broke with the consent of the governed, Jack. I mean, in a democracy, you can't make a bigger accusation than that.
Well, the consent of the governed was given in the election of 2008. We don't govern ourselves by the polls, thank heaven. And that was the Democrats were in control, that the president was, by a majority, elected. And, you know, Mr. Pence says it's not consistent with our past. It's very consistent, this act of government, with the philosophy of government of an earlier president from Illinois. He wrote, the legitimate object of government is to do for a community of people whatever they need to have done but cannot do at all or cannot do so well for themselves in their separate and individual capacities. That vision of positive government was from Abraham Lincoln, the father of the Republican Party. And this bill, this exercise in what Arthur Schlesinger calls the politics of remedy, is entirely consistent with that progressive view of government,
of course,
which is also consistent with our history.
Yes, but of course, David Gergen, Abraham Lincoln, presided during the Civil War. I mean, what do you make, I'm curious, David, of Mike Pence's charge that this breaks with history, turns its back on the traditions of limited government, a personal responsibility, and breaks with the consent of the governed? What do you say to that, David?
Well, this we're getting into deeper waters, aren't we? So this will be fun. Listen, I do think that Jack would remember that Abraham Lincoln was also a believer in self-reliance, a very strong believer in that. This is much more in the tradition of Franklin Roosevelt and Lyndon Johnson than of Lincoln. I think the point for modern times is that the Democrats, when they have embraced this vision for a long time, and when they have had large majorities, they've been able to work their will to do major pieces of legislation, such as Social Security. Back in the mid-30s, came when Franklin Roosevelt had an enormous majority, and Medicare, Medicaid came when Lyndon Johnson had enormous majorities after the 64 elections, and that enabled them to go forward. And here we've had two elections in a row, and Jack is right. The Democrats have won these two elections in 2006 and now 2008 that gave them the majorities, plus a persevering, very strong president and an extremely determined Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, who deserves a great deal of the credit for this. I must say the one thing that is the real – there are two things that are breaks with the past in terms of our social legislation. Mm-hmm. This is a point driven home to me by Daniel Patrick Moynihan when he was in the Senate and I was working in the Clinton White House on health care. And that is that in the past, stretching back to the New Deal, all the major social legislation has passed in a bipartisan way. It's had a significant number of votes from the other side. Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, Civil Rights 1964, Civil Rights 1965. You will find they all passed with a large number of Republicans, and that sadly, tragically, was not the case here.
But indeed, who's making is that, David? Is that really?
Well, let me just go back to one last point, and that is when it's not bipartisan, the public becomes much more divided, and I think that accounts in part for the sharp divisions we're now seeing over health care and why this is going to be a continuing battle, I'm afraid. And I hope it doesn't, and I share Bill's view, I hope it doesn't take to the streets as a result. But now, who is at fault here on why it wasn't bipartisan?
Well, wasn't it a deliberate policy of Republicans? I mean, going back to Bill Kristol in 1993 saying, you know, stonewall Clinton on health care, and this time the same. He should have zero Republican votes. Isn't that part of the reason there are none?
I think it's more complicated than
that. Of course.
I think that, yeah, of course the Republicans became virulently opposed to this bill. It's also true that in the beginning of the process, they were shut out of the conversations. They weren't at the table to put forward their ideas with regard to, say, malpractice, which has been very central to what the Republicans feel is important to ending the sort of malpractice laws we have.
But I remember week after week last summer in Max Baucus's committee, I mean, on and on, looking for the Republican input.
That's true. But I think in fairness, there is, if one is going to seek blame here, I think there's ample blame on both sides and among all parties. And Tom, there's also this point, which is very fundamental. Mm-hmm. There's a deep philosophical divide between these two parties. One has a view of private enterprise and self-reliant individuals. It's quite different from a Democratic view, which is much more the government is there to help people who can't help themselves, and it ought to embrace those people.
But is it a break for an American administration to embrace some of that, you know, government helping those who can't help themselves?
No, it's not a break from history.
That's what Mike Pence charges you.
No. I think he's making a different point, and that is that when this went to a vote, we've had a steady stream of polls leading up to this that show the public is opposed to it. Now, that raises a basic question, which Jack is, I think, brought into the forefront here in the conversation very, very well, and that is, who speaks for the country? When we send people to Washington, should they represent the voices of the people back home, or should they exercise independent judgment? Jack makes the point that they had a mandate coming out of the elections to go do this. The Republicans make the point, but look, the public didn't want this. Mm-hmm. So that's a really interesting argument.
David Gorgon,
what the responsibility is in democracy.
Yeah, a short break right here. Bill McKenzie, Jack Beatty. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, healthcare history, vigilante response, standoff with Israel. David Gergen is with us from Washington, D.C. Bill McKenzie of the Dallas Morning News is here, and Jack Beatty. Here's President Obama at a rally in Iowa City yesterday, challenging Republican lawmakers who opposed healthcare reform.
This is the reform that some folks in Washington are still hollering about, still shouting about. Now that they passed it, now that we passed it, they're already promising to repeal it. They're actually going to run on a platform of repeal in November. You've been hearing that. And my attitude is, go for it.
The president in Iowa City, and here's House Minority Whip Eric Cantor, Republican, Virginia, taking a swipe at Democratic Party leaders in a news conference yesterday, accusing them of fanning the flames by blaming the GOP for recent violence.
Security threats against members of Congress is not a partisan issue, and they should never be treated that way. To use such threats as political weapons is reprehensible. I'm not naive enough to think that letters, statements, or press releases will prevent anyone disturbed enough to commit violence from acting. But I do know that such letters, statements, and press releases can very easily fan the flames. By ratcheting up the rhetoric, some will only inflame these situations to dangerous levels.
By ratcheting up the rhetoric, where did that happen? Let's go to Kate in Nashville, Tennessee. Kate, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
First of all, I would like to say that Obama, when he ran for president, all of us were aware that health care was going to be one of his goals. And so all Americans, which were a majority, that voted for President Obama, realized that health care is an opportunity for all Americans to be able to have the opportunity to have health care. And we all knew that as a nation, and so we should rally behind the president's efforts in keeping his promise to America for giving us the opportunity to have access to health care.
But, Kate, what about those who deeply oppose this bill? What about them now?
Well, no matter what way you look at it, Tom, there's always going to be bills that people oppose. And usually you'll be surprised how many of the masses of people that really are for health care, they're just maybe silent, like a silent majority is the independent vote. And I am an independent voter. And when you see a lot of the people that are disruptive and it's coming from the Republican side, it's a very big turnoff, because a lot of the independents and even Democrats who actually voted for Obama say, well, look at that. They were not able to properly communicate their goals and their needs, and the only way that they're trying to get it through is to resort to violence. And that is not the answer.
Kate, we've got it loud and clear. Bill McKenzie, how do you see this unrolling? The Republicans say, you know, they are going for repeal, and that will be their battle cry in the midterm elections in November. We just heard President Obama saying, go for it. Mm-hmm. What do you think, Bill?
Well, a couple points. My wife and I have young children, and we're in the process of teaching them how to be good losers as well as good winners when we're putting puzzles and things like that together. And I've been thinking about that a lot, watching the Republicans respond to this and to some degree the Democrats. We've got to learn to be good losers in this country. And again, I want to be clear. I would have opposed this bill for the reasons I cited. But the bill has passed. We need to go on. And I think we now all need to own the bill. Like Colin Powell said about Iraq, we broke it, we now own it. And so we now need to make sure that this bill's cost containment pilot programs, for example, really work and they roll out and we help to control costs. We need to make sure that Congress needs to make sure, both parties, that they follow through on these Medicare reductions that are planned. $500 billion of this $900 plus billion bills paid for through Medicare reduction. So we're going to need to make sure that Congress, which has very poor track record in following through on Medicare cuts, does that so this bill doesn't explode the deficit. I think this idea of going out to sue to try to stop it on constitutional grounds, perhaps they have a legal argument. I've read articles to that effect. But I think that misses the point. We need to move on. And I think, it's a cliche, elections have consequences, this has passed, and I think we need to move on. I think David also raised, I think what is the central point here is the parties are increasingly divided, and that's not new. We know they've been divided. They were divided in Clinton times, but look even back in Clinton years. We had Gingrich and Clinton working together on welfare and deficit reduction, and even in 94 when health care was going on, you had John Chafee from your backyard there, Tom, working with Hillary Clinton trying to negotiate things. I don't remember all the other Republicans, but Chafee and some were out there negotiating. And I think we voters and citizens and need to really try to reward those who are willing to stick their necks out and work across party lines. For example, if Olympia Snowes and Susan Collins are trying to work in that to as they were back in the summer to try to negotiate something with Max Baucus, well, I think we need to make it possible for them to do that. Conversely, I think when people like Chet Edwards from my backyard, a Democrat from Central Texas, came out and opposed the bill, I think we need to make room for people like that to go against their party leadership. And so I think to some degree, the public have responsibility to create a safe space for people who will be willing to step out away from their parties.
But I don't know about good losers and safe space this week exactly. Here's some messages from the voicemail of Bart Stupak, Democrat, Michigan, opposed because of his opposition to abortion and finally came around to it. This is his voicemail after the vote.
We hate your guts here in real America. We despise you. Never talk like you, Stupak. Get out of office. Get off our property.
Congressman Stupak, you are one big piece of human and think about this. There are millions of people across the country who wish you ill.
Congressman Stupak, you may be killing you turncoat son of a I hope you bleed out your got cancer and die, you
David Gergen, is this just the price of being a politician in America these days?
Well, that obviously is extraordinarily offensive, and both parties have a responsibility to get that stopped in those cases. In this case with Bart Stupak, we were hearing from fringe elements on the right. If you played the tapes from the Republican congresswoman this last couple of days, you'd hear similar fringe elements from the left with similar kind of language, and terribly, terribly unfortunate. I associate myself very much with Bill McKenzie's view that the larger issue that we have to address now is costs. That is something that is, I think, has been deeply troubling to the country. I actually think, Bill, that's one of the reasons why large numbers of people oppose the bill to start with. And we're seeing it now in the bond markets where there's a skittishness now, and U.S. Treasuries are going down in price, which means that interest rates may go up over the skittishness about costs. But I do disagree with Bill over the question of, you being a good loser means you just sort of accept it and go on. That is not part of the American political tradition. The American political tradition is on very contentious elements. We continue to struggle over them for a long time. And when a majority decides there's been a mistake made, they change the bill. I would think, cite as recently as the late 1980s in healthcare, when the Congress passed a catastrophic healthcare bill to protect seniors. And when seniors started getting the bills, they revolted. And you can remember the scenes of Danny Rustenkowski, who was then chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, in Chicago being chased down the street by old women with umbrellas. And the Congress turned around and repealed that law. It was a major health care bill, and they repealed it. So there is there. I think there's legitimacy for people who think that this is bad law and a bad idea to take it to the voters this November. That's what President Obama himself said. Let's pass the bill and let's take it to the voters, and we'll see where it comes out this November. But to ask him to walk away, I think is
Jack. I want to come to you. I just want to say I want to ask you about exactly that vote. Especially, I mean, the Republicans have said, look at the polls. Americans do not support this. But then we've got a poll that came out after. USA Today Gallup poll showed a plurality, 49% in favor of the health care bill, 40% opposed. What do the polls turn around? Or what do you see coming in November, Jack? What are you hoping for here?
Well, the president says, if they do run against the bill this year, they're going to have to take on some of the following issues. 4 million small business people are going to get tax credits this year. Parents with children with pre-existing conditions, that pre-existing conditions for children go away this year.
Under the reform, that would be turned back.
That's
also,
right.
I guess. Yeah.
Insurance companies can't drop you if you get sick this year. There's free preventative care for the seniors this year. There's $250 to help close the donut hole for seniors drug this year, and on and on. So the Republicans are going to have to go to people who are getting benefits this year and say, you don't need those benefits. We're going to take it away from you.
But where does the country end up on this path?
That's a hard sell for the Republican Party. I want to ask David something. Mm-hmm. David, what's your reaction to this hypothesis? I think to curb or mute the Republican distemper, anyone who wishes well for the country must at some level hope that they win one or the other branches of government, of the Congress in November. That way they will have some responsibility for governing. And I think that is, to me, the only way I can see that they can be saved from this terrible Fox News cycle they're in, where, David Frum says, we thought Fox News was working for us. Turns out we're working for them. Give them some responsibility. Make them partners in government. What do you think?
I actually have come to the view, I'm not sure, Jack, that I would subscribe to everything you're saying. I don't quite feel the conservatives think they're trapped. I talked to someone who's running for the Senate and who's leading in a major state this year from the House, and he feels he loves to take these issues home as a Republican. He thinks he's going to win on these the health care issue as well as others. But your more fundamental point, I think, has actually got a lot to it, and that is if the Republicans, as they're likely to do, pick up seats in the House and the Senate. I hope that compels everyone in Washington to think about how are we going to work together, because the Republicans will then share responsibility for governing. And that would be a healthy thing for them to share that responsibility. But for Democrats to see, we really do need them at the table in order to go forward on some other things the Democrats are going to want to do in those 2 years, at the end, last 2 years of the Obama first term.
But David Jackson, you've got to win one House of Congress, or else
I'm not prepared to go there, but I do think that 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 the whole idea of winning seats and having larger numbers so they're not so totally outnumbered, I think is going to make a difference. I think it's going to move our politics more to the center and more to where the mainstream America is. I think a lot of mainstream Americans would like government. You know, we saw continuously in the polls that they would be much happier with this health care bill were it supported by both sides.
I guess that may be a great thing, but I don't know what I think about the or else way of campaigning back to majority. Mark, in Acton, Massachusetts. Mark, you're on the air.
Hi. You know, the public didn't dislike this bill before it was passed. They disliked what they heard about this bill. And David Frum, who wrote Bush's Axis of Evil speech, told us this week how that happened. He said that Obama's plan was actually pretty moderate. He said it was a lot like Mitt Romney's Massachusetts plan. But he said Republicans made a strategic decision. There would be no negotiations and no compromise, even though Obama wanted to do a deal. And he said Republicans were trapped by their own rhetoric. He said, how do you negotiate with somebody who wants to murder your grandmother? And then he did the thing that I think got him fired. He pulled back.
This is fired from the American Enterprise Institute after he came out with this perspective. Yeah.
Yeah. What I think got him fired was he pulled back the curtain and he showed us the little man from Oz who pulls the levers that made the last year so toxic. And that's Rupert Murdoch. And that's what Jack said. Frum said Republicans originally thought that Fox worked for us, and now we're discovering we work for Fox. So my question for David Gergen and people like him who made apologies for Fox all last year is why do they continue to treat Fox as a legitimate news source when Republican insiders like David Frum have known all along that it's nothing more than a propaganda arm of the most extreme elements of the Republican Party?
Well, we'll respond. David?
I guess I'm having a hard time understanding why the caller and some like him, you know, are so virulently anti-Fox. I disagree with a lot of what's on Fox. I have very strong personal disagreements with it. But you know, to have a we've had outlets in this country that conservatives have disagreed with for years. Including National Public Radio. Mm. And so, you know, to have to single out Fox, well, they're not legitimate and everybody else is, I think is somehow sort of a lopsided view of what this is a country of the First Amendment with free people should be able to be drawn to different voices. And if Fox is attracting a viewership as it is by, you know, pushing forward the world as seen through a conservative lens, and they draw a lot of viewers. As much as I may disagree with aspects of it, I defend to the death the right to say it.
Bill McKenzie, what do you make of David Frum's critique that, you know, here's a pretty much rock-solid conservative saying the Republicans have ended up working for Fox? Does that resonate with you, Bill, or not?
Well, I think to some extent, I mean, yes, there's an echo chamber in both parties. I mean, David is right in pointing out, you know, that, you know, National Public Radio or another MSNBC, let's talk about them for a second, Keith Olbermann, you know, people aren't going after them and critiquing Keith Olbermann for being on that side of the ledger. We have these echo chambers that go on both sides, liberal and conservative. And I think that's I think is a danger. I don't think there's anything we can or should do to stop it. I think we just need to continue to figure out ways to grow the middle and in various ways. I'd also like to interject this one thought, if I can, is we've been talking a lot about the Republicans. I think there's also a danger here for Democrats. I think if Democrats overread what happened this week as a mandate to go center-left on a number of other issues in the future, whether that's financial reform too far or you know, perhaps even education, then I think they are at risk of losing the country. I think generally speaking, we are more center-right. We go through periods of center-left corrections. But if Obama, Reid, and Pelosi think that we live in the in a center-left country, I just don't think that's the case.
I'm going to say we work hard not to have a echo chamber of any kind right here on NPR.
Correct.
No, that's all right. But, Jack, what about – we've just got a couple of seconds here. But Democrats going to overreach if they go center-left? Is that too much for Democrats to ask?
Well, it sounds as if the president is going to just focus. He's going to curb some of the menu. He's recognized he's not going to get cap and trade. That would be the most controversial move. Instead, they're going to focus on financial reform. And hearteningly, we see Republican senators saying, hey, we want to get on with this. And by the way, last night, the whole Senate stood for a moment of silence for Ted Kennedy. Democrats and Republicans alike, heads bowed.
I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, Cornell's Cinderella story in the Sweet 16 ended last night with a loss to number one seed Kentucky.
Kentucky impressively. Three straight games, three consuming victories for the number one seed in the East. The final score here, Kentucky 62, Cornell 45.
Vice President Joe Biden dropped an F surprise at the health care bill signing as he leaned in Tuesday to congratulate the president. The sound is faint. But the mic was on, and that was a big deal. Oh, boy. Tenor Johnny Maestro, lead singer to the Crest, the Del Satins, and the Brooklyn Bridge, died Wednesday at his home in Cape Coral, Florida. He was 70. But once, he sang about turning 16.
16 candles.
We're looking at a week in the news, healthcare history, vigilante response, standoff with Israel. The Dallas Morning News editorial columnist Bill McKenzie joins us from Texas. David Gergen is here from Washington, D.C., senior political analyst for CNN, former advisor to Nixon, Presidents Nixon, Ford, Reagan, and Clinton. Our own Jack Beatty is here. Steve, Woodstock, Virginia. You're on the air, Steve.
Yeah, Harrow. Thank you, Tom, for taking my call.
Sure.
concerning the Republican response to the health care bill, that we went against the will of the American people, that's their opinion. Like the previous caller said, we did elect President Obama to do just that. Mm-hmm. And I think the Republicans have forgot just a little bit. Back in the day when President Clinton was in office and the Republicans had the Lewinsky scandal going on, mm-hmm. on the steps of the Capitol, Dick Armey, Henry Hyde and Trent Lott were confronted with news reporters and asked the question that 86% of the American people were against the Republicans going through with this Lewinsky impeachment hearing thing, that the American people would rather get on with the people's business rather than wasting time on that. Dick Armey's response was, we don't care what public opinion is. We have a job to do, and we're going to do it. Do you remember that?
Mr. Gergen?
Steve makes an excellent point. He's right on that count. The Republicans did defy the will of the majority of the country then. They went on to pay a price for it reputationally and all sorts of other ways. I think most people felt that they went way too far. Turnabout is also a fair play. The American people have a chance to speak. I think this is going to be settled in the November elections. Let's let American voters have a chance to have their say. Yes, there's no question that people voted for Barack Obama in the 2008 election based in part on his call for health care reform. That was part of his mandate. Mm-hmm. He won it. He earned it fair and square. And he won by a significant majority. When this particular bill evolved, with the various trades that were associated with it, you know, there's a majority, a substantial plurality of the country regularly said, we don't want this bill. Now, the Democrats felt they had a higher, you know, they had a higher responsibility. They went forward. So let's settle it in the November elections. But by the way, in the meantime, don't you just love Joe Biden? He's so wonderfully unscripted.
He's loose.
He's one of these people that says, you know, there are people who are genuine still in politics. And I must say, I was in the Capitol last night with a group of students from NYU and Harvard too, who are scholarship students from the Reynolds Foundation. And we had John Dingell and Roy Blunt, a Democrat and a Republican, as well, along with John Lewis and then Nancy Pelosi. And when you get behind, when you open that curtain, you find there's actually a lot more sort of respect for each other across the aisle, and there can be a lot of affection and even friendship that we all worry is disappearing, but there are elements of it still there, and there is such a desire on the part of people who work inside the Congress to restore this sense of respect for each other, to listen to each other, to see if it can't work out agreements. I don't think anybody looks back upon... Yeah, the Democrats are proud of what was achieved, but I don't think anybody looks back upon the process as being one that's a healthy one.
Well, I'm glad you feel that because, you know, from the outside looking in, it's hard to see that there's that longing to restore respect. I mean, we don't hear it in the language.
These students were just floored and just inspired by the fact that John Dingell and his wife, you know, talks to Judge Roy Blunt's wife, you know, four or five times a week. They go on vacations together. They spend a lot of time here. John Dingell's been in the House for 55 years. He's a strong Democrat. Roy Blunt's a strong Republican.
Well, let's make more of that public before Absolutely. More windows are broken and more gas lines are cut, and we have more of those messages. Neil, Cambridge, Massachusetts, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, Neil.
I just wanted to address, like you said, about, we're talking about the vigilantism and the violence. You know, there's a lot of, obviously everyone's saying there's the extremists on both sides, which is true, but I think that sort of lays the blame too evenly. I think the Republican Party has been aligning themselves with people like, you know, Glenn Beck and Rush Limbaugh and Sarah Palin, really sort of appealing to the stupidest common denominator over the last, I don't know, you know, 10 years or so. And I think they're really reaping what they sow. They've been sort of stoking the flames of fanaticism, and now, you know, when that starts to come out, it's really rearing a pretty ugly head. It's pretty dangerous. And on the other hand, I don't think the Democrats have been doing all that great a job. I think they've been pretty spineless, but definitely they haven't been encouraging the sort of hate mongering that we see from Republicans.
So Bill McKenzie, what do you say? Thank you, Neil. Bill, what about the reaping what you sow argument there?
Well, let me go to what he was saying about the Democrats. I mean, you dial it back two or three years ago when George W. Bush was in there. I don't think you would. You know, there were quite a few Democrats who were pretty. Outspoken about their feelings about President Bush. So I think this can work both ways.
Yeah, but Democrats talked about going to Canada. Republicans seem to almost talk about secession. There's a different instinct, maybe.
Well, if you can explain that, I'd like to know it.
Well, I mean, all this nullification and states not agreeing to go along,
right.
You know.
Well, I agree. I agree with the caller that to some extent Republicans are reaping what they've sown. I don't dispute that at all. And you kind of become known by who your friends are. And I think that is a danger. And that's, again, why I think, we need to find space for people who will move independently from their party leadership, because I don't think the party leadership is going to move very independently on its own.
Jack, what do you make of Eric Cantor saying, hey, Democrats, stop talking about all this violence. You're fanning the flames.
Well, I think that's just a piece of political jujitsu on his part, and a very clumsy one, too. You know, I'm this flair of threats and violence puts me in mind of a line of Yeats's. We had fed the heart on fantasy. The heart's grown brutal from the fare. And, you know, I'm not saying the Republicans are solely responsible for this. There are crazy people out there. But when you start calling people baby killers, when you talk about killing grandma...
Shouted on the floor of the House.
When you say that this is socialism, that Obama is introducing a socialist utopia, a government takeover of health care, well... That's as, I mean, if it's a baby killer, aren't I justified? If the person is a baby killer of the party, aren't I justified in striking out at him? That's that feeding the heart on fantasy, and it's a fantasy that the Republicans, you know, they haven't been against it. Some have, certainly, on Bill's grounds, that we just can't afford it, that this is going to explode the deficit, despite what the CBO says, and that we just have to get our finances in order before we go ahead. That's right. That's a valid criticism of this experiment. That's not what the Republicans in the main have been saying.
We've got more news on the griddle this week, from the U.S. and Israel to gays in the military and the Pope's situation, Google and China. Let's turn to some of that, if we may. Here's Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. This was on Monday in Washington, addressing the lobbying group AIPAC. She reiterated the Obama administration's opposition to Israel's housing policy.
New construction in East Jerusalem or the West Bank undermines that mutual trust and endangers the proximity talks that are the first step toward the full negotiations that both sides say they want and need. And it exposes daylight between Israel and the United States that others in the region hope to exploit.
Hope to exploit. David Gergen, what do you make of this and the very odd Obama-Netanyahu meeting at the White House where they met for an hour and a half? Then the president goes upstairs for dinner. Netanyahu sits in another room with his people for an hour and a half, comes back to see the president for half an hour. What is going on here, David?
Well, first, let me thank Jack. But anybody can quote Yates on public radio early in the morning. You have to welcome that.
Bravo.
It makes us all look better, better than we should. This is one of the most troubling episodes, I think, in a while in U.S.-Israeli relations. And it's clear that the personal chemistry between Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Obama is very bad. They don't like each other. I don't think they like each other's style. I don't think they like what each other stands for. And increasingly, there is a view in the U.S. government, as General Petraeus put it in his testimony, which was quite interesting this last few days. There's increasingly a view in the U.S. government that the continuation of these tensions between the Israelis and the Palestinians harms America's interests in other parts of the Muslim world, and it makes it more difficult in places like Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. So the U.S. is really anxious to push this forward. At the same time, and Mr. Netanyahu, we have someone who is in a very fragile government and who himself is, of course, a hardliner, and who feels he's being the U.S. is making demands that no Israeli prime minister could meet with regard to East Jerusalem and settlements in East Jerusalem. It's one thing to talk about the West Bank. It's another thing to be talking about settlements there. They're really at loggerheads. And I think that there's a we're sort of on a knife edge because in terms of relations.
Bill McKenzie, where do you see this going?
Well, I agree in that we're in a bad place. We had an interview yesterday at our editorial board with Jim Steinberg, who's the Deputy Secretary of State. And maybe it's the optimist in me that wants to bring this point up. We talked about this issue at length, and we asked him, how do we get beyond kind of a dismal situation? He said, well, I'm not sure I'm going to call it dismal. He said, if you go to to the West Bank today and you see some of the stability and the social capacity, I think is the word he used, that is being built there slowly, that gives you some room for encouragement. But, you know, we've got two sides that somehow we have to get them off the dime. Reading the politics of this, of the two leaders, of Obama and Netanyahu, I don't think that's going to be any time soon. I hope it is, but I don't think it is.
Boy, I mean, fierce response from Israel in the press there about the prime minister being humiliated in Washington. And, the analysis that I was hearing on NPR this morning that Netanyahu will now have to decide between, an internal situation where acceding to what Washington's asking could lose his coalition there, or, a deeper break with Washington. Trouble. Let's go to Robert in Lowell, Massachusetts. Robert, you're on the air.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Don't you think that they're jeopardizing American lives by this aggressive attitude toward the Palestinians? It just seems that Israel pushes the Palestinians and then they overreact and do something ridiculous like...
Robert, you got to turn your radio down. It's kind of hard to catch you there. Let me get one more. Stephen in Windham, Connecticut. Stephen, you're on the air.
Hi, fellas. You guys are all the way in the pool now. Forget about wading in the deeper waters. I'm calling about East Jerusalem. I'm not too keen on that whole policy until 9/11, and then I focus more on it. But to me, it looks like the Orthodox Jewish people in East Jerusalem are running U.S. foreign policy, and it reminds me of the divine right of kings. I mean, how long have they been stiffing Americans this way? And when David Petraeus speaks up, I listen.
Well, but here's Netanyahu's response pretty much on Tuesday before AIPAC. Stephen, let's listen.
Israel shares with America everything, and I mean everything, that we know about fighting a new kind of enemy. We share intelligence. We cooperate in so many ways, countless ways, which I'm not at liberty to divulge. This cooperation is important for us, for Israel, but it is also helping save American lives.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Tuesday. Jack Beatty, do you see this relationship fundamentally shifting here? A bad pass or something new emerging? It's unusual the way the Pentagon has spoken up. Now we've got the Prime Minister and the President at kind of loggerheads. Wow, where are we going?
Well, in today's Times, Ethan Broner from Israel writes that American officials said their goal was not to make the Netanyahu government collapse, but that without a reduction in building in East Jerusalem, peace talks would be imperiled. I think that is the goal. They do want the government to collapse. I'm not familiar, all that familiar with the domestic politics of Israel, but I think the Obama people must be hoping for something like a repeat of what James Baker was able to do back in the Bush 1 administration, which was essentially to get into a face-off with an incumbent Israeli prime minister and spark a rebellion against him and force him out of office or to change his coalition. And I think that's what I suspect that's their hope, that he could get better coalition partners, perhaps a more liberal polity, who knows. But, of course, what's changed is that Obama has very little sway in Israel. Of all the countries in the world, I think his polling numbers there are as low as any place. So it may not be that we have that leverage anymore.
David Gergen, if that's the game, who's got the stronger hand here?
Well, I certainly hope it's not the game. The United States would have no business trying to interfere in the domestic politics of Israel and trying to bring down a government. It is true, Jack Beatty's absolutely right. President Obama's popularity there is in the teens, like 16-17%, the last poll I saw there. But I want to come back to one point about this. It is true that the Palestinians have endured great suffering, and there is much to be said on their side. But let's also remember, it was the Israelis who pulled back from Lebanon and then got shelled. It was the Israelis who pulled back in the name of peace from Gaza and got shelled. This is not exactly a one-sided affair. The Palestinians the extremists have a lot to answer for here as well. From my point of view, there's an analogy with the healthcare thing, and that is, I think it's best if both sides now try to compose their differences, get this quieted down, and move forward, because the U.S.-Israeli relationship has been pretty important and will continue to be important for stability in that part of the world.
Well, a big week at home, one for the history books, and a big week right in this relationship as well. There's more on the table, but that's all we're going to get to this hour. It's been great to have all of you with us. David Gergen, now at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, advisor formerly to Presidents Nixon, Ford, Reagan, and Clinton. David Gergen, it is always great to have you. Thank you very much for
being
here.
Thank you, Tom. It was a privilege, especially hearing about Yates.
Bring on Yates. More Yates. Bill McKenzie, the Dallas Morning News. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. David, Jack.
Jack, another line of Yates? A word? A bon mot? Who's off? Thanks, Jack. Thanks for being with us. Listeners, have a great weekend. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.